Hello, this is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with the Wednesday, September 6th reading of Newsweek magazine. From the news, Burning Man update as festival goers could be stranded for days by Julia Carbonaro. Thousands of festival goers who have been stranded at Burning Man after heavy downpours turned the desert landscape into thick mud pit said they might be unable to leave for days as more rain fell on Sunday afternoon. More than 70,000 people flocked to the annual festival in the Black Rock Desert in Nevada and are now trapped in a huge quagmire. With roads in and out of the site closed, more than half an inch of rain fell overnight on Friday, according to organizers quoted by Sky News, and there was more rainfall on Saturday and Sunday. Festival goers have been told to stay in their camps and preserve food and water. In their latest update on Sunday evening, organizers said they were aiming to open for exodus on Monday morning, with a final decision on access expected to be announced by 9 a.m. local time. The site was shut down by Nevada's Bureau of Land Management on Saturday because of the downpours. The death of one person is being investigated by authorities, though police have provided no more details other than saying it occurred during this rain event. Please stay off of Gate Road. Rain and mud make it impassable at the moment. We have created alternative routes that, if used on Monday, you'll be flagged to the best area to drive across, organizers wrote on Sunday. The majority of the rain has passed, with partially cloudy skies and a chance of showers and thunderstorms for the rest of the daylight hours, they added. A slight chance of showers and thunderstorms linger into the evening of Sunday, September 3rd. Gusty winds are still possible today and this evening. Monday will bring clear skies and a welcome chance to dry out. However, festival goers appear more pessimistic than organizers. One wrote on X, formerly known as Twitter, late on Sunday night that people were allowed to leave but were strongly advised against trying to do so. Gates are not officially open yet, but if you have a four-wheel drive vehicle, you're allowed to leave, but you run the risk of getting stuck, so they are advising us to stay put for now, they wrote on the social media platform. Currently, there are hundreds of vehicles stuck due to mud, clay at the Exodus line. If you're willing to walk the 5 to 10 miles, you're allowed to leave by foot. Also not advised. If you have a medical emergency, you'll be escorted out by medics and an emergency vehicle. Organizers said that while some vehicles had managed to leave, others remained stuck in the mud as of Sunday morning. The festival goer added that there was no date on when gates will open, but once they are, it will be about a 20-hour process to get the masses out of the city. Our plan as a camp is to leave after the first wave to not get stuck in line, looking like a Thursday exit if the weather holds up. From the U.S., Marjorie Taylor Greene says Burning Man flooding an act of God by Khalida Rahman. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene has claimed that flooding at the Burning Man Festival was an act of God. The annual gathering attracts almost 80,000 people to the Nevada desert to dance, make art, and enjoy being part of a self-sufficient temporary community. This year's event began on August 27th and was scheduled to run through Monday, but tens of thousands were left stranded after flooding from storms swept through the desert, turning it into a sea of sticky mud. After a death was reported, organizers closed the festival to vehicles and ordered attendees to shelter in place. Authorities on Sunday said a person had died during the rain event in the Black Rock Desert, but provided few details. An investigation is underway. Green, a Republican from Georgia who has a history of promoting conspiracy theories, said on Alex Jones's InfoWars show on Sunday night that the people stranded in the desert are basically probably being brainwashed that climate change is the cause of all of it, and it's going to destroy the earth. When Jones claimed that festival goers did a mock sacrifice and then it flooded with these tornadoes, Green suggested the extreme weather was a punishment from God because of it. God has a way of making sure everyone knows who God is, she said. I'll say that about it. The road closures and orders came before the burning of a large wooden structure called the Man on the festival's penultimate night took place. Organizers said on Sunday night that the burning is scheduled to take place on Monday morning. On their website, they said they did not yet know when the roads would be dry enough for RVs or vehicles to navigate safely, but they said vehicles could depart by late Monday if weather conditions improved. On Jones's show, Green also claimed that attendees will spread climate change propaganda when they return home. "It's the same thing, same way they launch any kind of movement," she said. "After this is over and Burning Man and these 75,000 people dispersed and they go back home, they're going to have these stories to tell and how terrible it is and how we have to do everything possible to stop climate change. It's caused by humans and it's carbon." Some also took to social media to claim Burning Man attendees were being punished by God. Wow, God unleashed a plague and a flood of rain over the satanic ritual Burning Man in the desert that all of the elites attend. You don't say. Andrew Torba, the founder of Gab, a fringe social media platform that has become a breeding ground for white nationalists and other extremists, wrote on X, formerly Twitter. "They're all blaming climate change for the rain. In reality, it's probably God punishing them all for their degeneracy," another person wrote on X. However, some question how Green would explain extreme weather in other places, including in her home state. "What would she say about the hurricane that just went through Georgia?" one person asked. From politics, Rudy Giuliani sealed his own fate in legal loss, according to a constitutional lawyer, by Thomas Kika. Rudy Giuliani sealed his own fate in a Georgia defamation suit that should have been his case to lose, according to constitutional lawyer Jerry Weber. On Wednesday, Georgia Judge Burl Howell ruled against the former New York City mayor in a civil defamation suit brought against him by mother-daughter state election workers Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss. Giuliani, acting in his capacity as a legal advisor to Donald Trump, previously made false claims that the pair had committed fraud during the 2020 election, making them two of the most prominent targets for the ire of the former president's supporters. Howell's ruling against Giuliani was by a default judgment, as the judge found that he had failed to comply with a number of subpoenas, particularly those pertaining to the lawsuit's discovery phase. The judge, in a 57-page opinion, called the discovery material that he turned over insufficient. A jury will now decide how much Giuliani must pay to Freeman and Moss for his defamatory remarks. Giuliani has already been sanctioned almost $90,000 for the poll workers' attorney's fees in the case, and Powell said that there would be additional sanctions. In an opinion column for MSNBC on Sunday, Weber, a constitutional law attorney and adjunct professor at Emory University School of Law, wrote that Giuliani effectively sealed his own fate by failing to adequately provide discovery materials. Had he responded to the subpoenas to the satisfaction of the court, he might have prevailed in the case, given the historically high burden of proof plaintiffs in defamation cases must meet, Weber added. But this was Giuliani's case to lose, Weber wrote. Famously, defamation cases are hard for plaintiffs to win, and purposefully so. Since the New York Times versus Sullivan 1964, the Supreme Court has set a high bar for plaintiffs in libel cases because the First Amendment requires breathing space to citizens and the press. He continued, "False statements are not always defamatory. For false statements about famous and powerful people, there must be actual malice, meaning the speaker knows that they are false or makes them with reckless disregard for the truth. Freeman and Moss are not powerful folks, and for them the legal path is easier." Weber further noted that in July, Giuliani's legal team said in a filing that he did not contest the notion that his statements about Freeman and Moss were false. He did, however, attempt to argue that the pair had not offered any damage as a result of his statements. In her decision, Howell also accused Giuliani of destroying evidence relevant to the case. Weber wrote in his column that such actions directly risked being handed a default judgment, which he called the nuclear bomb of consequences in any lawsuit. From the world, Ukraine could make rapid counteroffensive gains after first-line breach. By Ellie Cook. Ukraine stands to make significant progress into Russian-controlled territory after reportedly breaking through Moscow's first line of defenses in the south of the country, making all that hard fighting worth it, an expert has told Newsweek. Kiev's fighters are now between the first and second defensive lines, Ukraine's commander of the Tavria group of forces, Brigadier General Alexander Tarnavsky, told British newspaper The Observer in an article published on Saturday. Ukraine began its concerted push against Moscow's forces in the south and east of the country in early June, but initially struggled to retake significant amounts of land. A delayed start to the counteroffensive gave Russia time to mine much of the territory and to establish well-defended positions in advance of Ukraine's operations getting underway. In the center of the offensive, we are now completing the destruction of enemy units that provide cover for the retreat of Russian troops behind their second defensive line, he said. Getting through Russia's defensive lines is key to Ukraine then moving from a tactical breakthrough battle to mobile warfare and operational exploitation. Frederick Mertens, a strategic analyst with the Hague Center for Security Studies, told Newsweek, "This will have the double goal of cutting through the land bridge and destroying as many Russian units as possible," Martin said. "This would be the military reward that makes all that hard fighting worth it for Ukraine," he added. The news is one of Ukraine's messages to Russian President Vladimir Putin, Lithuania's former defense and foreign minister Linas Linkevičius wrote on X, formerly known as Twitter. "It is expected that the counteroffensive will speed up from here on out," political strategist and consultant Jason J. Smart added on social media. In late August, the Institute for the Study of War, ISW think tank, said Ukraine may have broken through the most difficult line of Russian defenses in the contested Zaporizhia region of southern Ukraine. "There is a very big difference between the first and second line of defense," Tarnavsky told The Observer. Kiev had made new tactically significant gains in Russian-annexed regions in the south of the country, with its fighters pushing through some of the most challenging defensive positions, the ISW said in an assessment published on August 26. In a little over a week since this analysis, experts and Ukrainian officials have suggested Ukraine was bearing down on Russian forces in Zaporizhia, working their way towards the occupied city of Melitopol and the Sea of Azov. There have been some successes, in particular in the direction of Novodevichy and Novopropkovka, Ukraine's deputy defense minister Hanna Malar said on Thursday, referring to two Zaporizhia villages. On Friday, the White House said it had seen some notable progress by Ukraine over the previous days in Zaporizhia. "They have achieved some success against that second line of Russian defenses," White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby told the media. "In my opinion, the Russians believed the Ukrainians would not get through this line of defense," Ukraine's Tarnavsky said. "They had been preparing for over 1 year. They did everything to make sure that this area was prepared well." The following day, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed Ukraine's troops were making progress and were on the move against Russia's dug-in soldiers and well-defended positions. "Ukrainian forces are moving forward," he said in a post to social media. "Despite everything and no matter what anyone says, we are advancing, and that is the most important thing. We are on the move." Russian forces have targeted several Zaporizhia settlements over the past 24 hours, Ukraine's general staff said in an operational update on Sunday morning. "The defensive forces of Ukraine continue to conduct an offensive operation in the Melitopol direction, strengthen on the reached borders, and carry out counter-battery resistance measures," the general staff added. Russian troops repelled three attacks from Ukrainian brigades around the contested Zaporizhia settlements of Robotyne and Verbov to the south of the city of Orakhiv, Russia's defense ministry said on Sunday. From the cover, "Science Says Everything You Know About Food, Diet, and Drugs is Wrong," by David H. Freeman. The artificial sweetener aspartame is found in most diet sodas and more than 6,000 other food products consumed by hundreds of millions of people around the world. So, on July 14th, when a group working under the auspices of the World Health Organization warned that the sweetener possibly causes cancer and that high consumers of aspartame-sweetened products were at risk, the news went viral. So did pronouncements a few days later that aspartame was in fact pretty safe. The World Health Organization announcement doesn't mean aspartame is linked to cancer, an official from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration told NPR, and a second committee of the World Health Organization agreed. Are you confused yet? Public health messaging is often a difficult tightrope walk. See COVID-19, and that is especially true for anything related to food, a matter of profound importance and intense public interest about which science can't seem to make up its mind. Nutrition scientists and other food and health experts have for years been feeding the public conflicting and muddled advice about food, diet, and health. It is a good idea to count calories, avoid carbs, load up on meat. Is it best to eat only natural foods, avoid gluten, go vegan? Science can't provide definitive answers. It's no wonder, then, that the recent wave of seemingly magical cures and miracle regimes, diets that emphasize intermittent fasting, nurturing good gut bacteria, and cutting out carbs have surged in popularity, but their basis in science is sketchy. The arrival of a new generation of astonishingly effective weight loss drugs offers the tantalizing prospect of blunting America's obesity problem, but it's not clear if a lifetime drug regime will be safe or affordable for the 42% of Americans who are obese. It's very hard for consumers to find consistent dietary advice, says Regan Bailey, a professor of nutrition at Texas A&M University, where she is associate director of precision nutrition for the Institute for Advancing Health Through Agriculture. For every study that finds a particular approach works, another one comes out that's against it. Getting to the bottom of diet science won't be easy. Part of the problem is that research on food is terrifically challenging. To do it right requires tracking what people eat over long periods of time, which is expensive, and keeping them on diet plans that they may not like, which is as easy as herding cats. Because health problems tend to emerge over many years from complex causes, it's difficult to trace them directly to diet alone, never mind particular foods or individual ingredients. That's why so many theories abound that may not have a sound scientific basis. What's needed more than new theories are practical solutions grounded in the relatively small universe of unimpeachable facts about how to eat healthfully. That's true in the realm of public policy, where a movement is afoot to protect children from the ravages of the food industry. In July, for instance, the World Health Organization called for countries around the world to implement regulations with a particular eye to protecting children from junk food marketing. It's also true in the myriad decisions individuals have to make when shopping, cooking, and deciding what to have for lunch or feed the kids. Although much of the dietary advice currently circulating in the zeitgeist is questionable, Newsweek has shifted through the myriad competing and confounding claims and separated what is factual about healthful eating from what is merely speculative. What's left are a few bedrock principles to keep in mind. Do calories really matter? Making the diets of Americans healthier has long been primarily about reducing the rate of obesity, and for good reason, notes Howard Sachs, a physician and associate professor at the University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School. When I see a patient who's overweight, I have to consider whether this person is at risk of cardiac disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, arthritis, and sleep apnea, he says. For more than half a century, doctors and public health experts have been pushing out the message that recommending changes in diet is the best way of tackling the problem of excess weight. Research strongly links exercise to better health, but not in any clear way to weight loss. The conventional recommendation for healthful weight loss has been some form of calorie tracking with a goal of reducing daily total calorie consumption. This approach tends to place less emphasis on which foods to eat and more on an overall diet that is as satisfying as possible while still trimming calories. Research has consistently found that diets involving some form of calorie tracking, such as Weight Watchers, which uses a point system loosely based on calories, are on average more effective than other approaches to losing weight and keeping it off. But there's a big catch. Most people fail on these diets anyway. Studies have shown, for example, that the great majority of people with obesity who are encouraged by a physician to lose weight through dietary changes don't lose weight at all, and more than two-thirds of those who do lose weight on a doctor's advice gained more than two-thirds of the weight back, on average, within 3 years, according to a 2018 review study by the National Institutes of Health, NIH, and Johns Hopkins University. The poor track record of the calorie-based approach to health eating is one reason it has been under fire in recent years. Some experts have called into question the notion that people should be encouraged to make dietary changes to overcome obesity at all on the grounds that it's too difficult and can be pointlessly shaming. Recognizing that most people struggle to cut calories, various dietary scientists and clinicians have pushed alternatives to the calorie tracking paradigm. One that gets a lot of attention is the very low carbohydrate diet, often referred to as a keto diet, the most popular diet among those that restrict particular food types, according to a 2022 study published in the journal Current Developments in Nutrition. More than 23 million people say they follow keto diets, according to the International Foods Information Council, fueling a $12 billion a year industry supplying foods tailored to keto, according to the market research firm Mordor Intelligence. The theory behind the diet, most prominently championed by Harvard University researcher and physician David Ludwig, is that people gain excess weight not when they consume too many calories, but when their bodies lose the ability to deliver the energy from food to muscles. That happens, the theory goes, because refined sugar and carbohydrates from grains and fruits, which the body breaks down into another type of sugar, tend to flood too quickly into the bloodstream, leading the body to produce large amounts of insulin to try to get the sugar to the muscles. Over time, muscles can become resistant to those big hits of insulin, and the body ends up converting the sugars to body fat instead. The keto solution to this insulin resistance is to stop eating just about all carbs. People on full keto diets typically try to get about three-quarters of their calories from fat and almost all the rest from protein. A big attraction of keto is that adherents can eat large portions of whatever non-carb food they want, feasting freely, for example, on steak, cheese, and eggs, as unhealthy as that may sound. Research tends to back the notion that sticking with a keto diet can lead to losing excess weight, working on average about as well as a calorie tracking approach. Keto also reduces the risk of diabetes. Most experts, though, are skeptical of the keto diet. The large amounts of saturated fat typically consumed by keto adherents can lead to high cholesterol levels closely linked to heart disease, as confirmed by a 46-year-old study involving more than 18,000 subjects published in 2021 in JAMA Cardiology, among other studies. Fruits and whole grains, which get cut out in a keto diet, are also generally considered important components of a healthy diet. In addition, when people deprive themselves of ubiquitous, convenient, much-loved foods, such as pasta, bread, and most desserts, they're likely to develop cravings that make it nearly impossible for them to stick with the diet over the long term, researchers say. It's not helpful to focus on just one component of diet, says Michelle Cardell, a registered dietitian and assistant professor at the University of Florida and senior director of global clinical research and nutrition at Weight Watchers. The Mediterranean diet is a more highly regarded healthy eating scheme. While there isn't a specific Mediterranean diet industry, Weight Watchers and most other popular services offer ways to adhere to a diet more or less in keeping with its principles. There's no official definition of the diet, but a key component is eating more unsaturated fats, such as those found in olive oil, nuts, and especially oily fish. Advocates also advise eating vegetables, whole grains, and lean sources of protein, such as poultry and beans, while cutting down on sugar, red meat, and saturated fat. Studies show that people who follow Mediterranean diet tend to show a reduced risk of heart disease. They're also less likely to be obese, even though calorie tracking isn't part of the diet. However, these studies haven't established beyond a doubt that people who eat this way are healthier from the diet alone. It's possible that people who follow a Mediterranean diet are healthy due to other factors, such as exercise and moderate calorie intake, and are simply more likely than others to eat this way. A 2022 Stanford University study, however, did convincingly show that Mediterranean diet worked as well as much more restrictive keto diet in fending off insulin resistance. Other diet approaches include plant-based diets, gluten-free diets, microbiome diets that aim to regulate gut bacteria, and fasting during certain times each day. Studies show some health benefits to each approach, but there is no convincing evidence that anyone is better than the other at making its adherence healthier. For most of the public, they hold little appeal as a way of eating. Still, these diets have their vocal supporters. Intermittent fasting, in particular, has quickly become the most popular diet in the U.S., according to the International Food Information Council. About 1 out of 10 people who say they're following a diet claim intermittent fasting is their preferred approach. The theory behind it is that frequent fasting can help people get out of the habit of constantly eating and gives the body time to focus on burning the food that has already been eaten, rather than on digesting new food. Fasting can also trigger a stress response in the body that promotes cell repair. Usually, intermittent fasters say they fast either for entire days, 2 or more days a week, or else for a large chunk of the day. There is no agreed-upon measure for what counts as intermittent fasting, other than following some sort of timing scheme in eating. The big appeal to this approach is being able to eat without restrictions, except, of course, when fasting. Intermittent fasting has its downsides, the biggest one having to fast off and on for the rest of your life. Fasting also doesn't do a better job of taking off excess weight than conventional calorie tracking, according to a joint Northwestern University and University of Illinois study published in July in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And weight loss via the calorie approach delivers the same cell repair benefits without having to fast, according to a 2017 study published in the Aging Research Reviews. Microbiome diets are fast gaining in popularity. The idea is to eat food that is friendly to good bacteria that lives in the intestines, which has been shown to have an influence on mental and physical well-being, and unfriendly to bad bacteria. The approach encourages high-fiber foods like fruits and vegetables. Certain vegetables, such as leeks, asparagus, and seaweed, are held to be especially helpful to maintaining a healthy microbiome. Research has shown that the type and quantity of bacteria in the gut can indeed be linked to both weight and health, but there has yet to be any solid proof that switching to particular microbiome-promoting foods can reliably produce improvements. One of the most promising approaches, still in its infancy, is that of precision nutrition, which aims to tailor a diet to suit each individual's unique biology, health, lifestyle, and goals. An $8 billion industry has already sprung up to cater to would-be precision nutrition eaters, offering a range of lab tests and questionnaires, assisted, in some cases, by artificial intelligence. Research is in the early stages, most notably an NIH study announced in May that will enroll 10,000 people to examine how AI can determine which foods raise or lower health risks for individuals. Most experts say that effective precision nutrition schemes are still years off. Any of these diets can work as long as they reduce calorie intake, says Jamie Ard, a physician, epidemiologist, and vice dean for research, clinical research at Wake Forest University, and president-elect of the Obesity Society, an influential academic research association. Yes, calories matter. Downplaying that does people a disservice by getting them to focus on the wrong things, he says. I see people eating only organic, natural, healthy foods, and they can't figure out why they're gaining weight. Many of the new diets are too expensive for most people. They often involve having to buy more fresh, whole foods, which can be out of reach of people with low incomes, who also tend to be at highest risk of diet-related poor health. And some of the diets may simply be unappealing for many. The right diet has to come down to what's livable and sustainable for you, says University of Florida's Cardell. A new villain. If a dietary science hasn't already given us a large enough crop of competing diet theories, researchers have been busy promoting a new one. Blame it all on ultra-processed foods. The food industry is all too eager to ply the public with fatty, sugary, calorie-dense foods it craves. Americans get about half their calories from junk food, according to a 2022 study from the University of North Carolina and other researchers, with a predictable impact on health. But a spate of studies over the past 5 years have made the increasingly strident claim that the food industry is churning out food products that are attacking health in ways that go beyond merely cramming them with fat and sugar. Ultra-processed foods, insist some researchers, are the sole cause of climbing obesity rates and all our food-related health problems. The evidence, however, does not definitively support these claims. The term ultra-processed was introduced in 2009 by Carlos Monteiro, a nutrition researcher at the University of São Paulo in Brazil, who defined it as food prepared with ingredients and equipment not found in most kitchens. More than two-thirds of all food sold by the packaged food industry falls into that definition, including most plain yogurt sold in supermarkets, leading some scientists to question the term's value. There's no agreed-upon scientific meaning for it, says Texas A&M's Bailey. The label, she notes, can imply baby carrots from a supermarket are bad for you, while equally improbably deeming candy made in a home kitchen perfectly healthy. To avoid confronting that apparent contradiction, most researchers seem to treat the term as a catchier, more scientific-sounding way of describing junk food. Studies that link the consumption of junk food to obesity and chronic disease have failed to establish cause and effect. In other words, it's not clear whether junk food alone is making healthy people sick, or people who eat junk food also tend to be more vulnerable to health problems for other reasons, such as lack of exercise and lack of access to good health care, education, and other resources. A 2019 study from Harvard found that junk food eaters are not only more vulnerable to heart disease, but they also have higher rates of death from injury, which supports the notion that junk food may not be the only factor. The claims about ultra-processed foods grew louder after a 2019 National Institute of Health study in which 20 people were put on an ultra-processed diet. Examples, mac and cheese, chicken nuggets, for 2 weeks, and on a minimally processed diet, oatmeal, salad, grilled chicken, for 2 weeks. The balance of fat, protein, and carbs were the same for the two diets, and the subjects were allowed to eat as much as they wanted at each meal. The results, they ate about 500 calories per day more of the ultra-processed diet, gaining weight from it. The study didn't make clear how ultra-processed foods lead to more calorie intake, but those foods did pack in far more calories per mouthful than the non-ultra-processed versions. And many researchers, including those who ran the study, point out such calorie density promotes excess eating. That's because cramming more fat and sugar into a single bite, as most junk foods do, makes foods taste and feel extremely stimulating and satisfying. They're hyper-palatable. Many researchers and healthy eating advocates interpret the results of that NIH study to claim that it represents a newly discovered special harm from the food sold by the prepared food industry beyond its well-known appeal and calorie density. It's possible that something as of yet unidentified about junk food is causing special harm, but scientists haven't clearly established that claim. However, that hasn't stopped some researchers from insisting that it's real and doing damage. Montero, the researcher who coined the term, is one of those researchers claiming special harm. Sugar in ultra-processed food creates a lot of problems, but not the sugar in homemade desserts, he says. The fact that we still don't know what links ultra-processed to different diseases can't be used as a reason to ignore the evidence. The claim of special harm beyond hyper-palatability might be settled by studies comparing, say, food company mac and cheese to home-cooked mac and cheese, rather than comparing it to a salad. But researchers don't seem eager to clarify that point. The key question about ultra-processed foods aren't being addressed, says Cardell. Another point that needs to be taken into account is the difficulty many people would have in giving up highly processed foods, she says. I don't find the fear-mongering over ultra-processed food helpful. It's elitist and unrealistic to assume everyone can just switch to an unprocessed diet. Drugs for weight loss. Amid the confusion, meanwhile, there's good news for the multitudes who have struggled unsuccessfully against the pull of junk food. A new generation of diabetes and weight loss drugs is flipping the long, discouraging odds for successfully losing weight for many people with obesity. These drugs, including Ozempic, Wegovy, and Mounjaro, imitate certain hormones that can reduce appetite and cravings. They are a game changer, says the University of Massachusetts' Sachs. I have patients who have never been able to lose an ounce, losing 20 pounds in 3 months. It's phenomenal. Currently, these drugs must be injected every 2 or 4 weeks, but pill versions are on the drawing board, which will likely add to the interest in taking them. These drugs come with drawbacks. For one thing, health insurance covers most of the costs only for those people diagnosed with diabetes, or in some cases for patients with another significant obesity-related health problem, such as heart disease. Others who hope to enlist the drugs for weight loss and can get a prescription would have to shell out nearly $1,000 a month, as would anyone who doesn't have a good health care insurance. No matter how sick they are. Obesity and its related ills disproportionately fall on the poor and those in groups traditionally underserved by health care. The people who are most at risk for obesity usually don't have insurance, says Bailey. Costs may eventually come down, but right now there's little sign of that happening anytime soon. Other drawbacks to the new drugs include gastrointestinal distress and other side effects. And stopping the drugs tends to result in regaining all the weight, which means most people would need to stay on them for the rest of their lives to keep the weight off. The drugs are so new that the potential long-term side effects have not yet been studied. For these reasons, dietary changes are likely to remain the main approach to losing excess weight for some time. I don't know if we'll ever see a day when people can just take a drug and not have to worry about what they eat, says Wake Forest's Ard. He notes that even people who are on the drugs have to pay close attention to what they eat, because a poor diet could lead to muscle loss or other health problems, or might even interfere with weight loss. The limits of knowledge. The problems of dietary science stem from the enormous complexity of the relationship between food and health, and the length of time, the better part of a lifetime, it takes for many health problems to appear. Most diet and health research is based on cohort studies in which the health of people who eat a certain way is compared to the health of those who eat differently. But while cohort studies can show that a certain diet seems associated with certain health problems, they can't show whether or not the diet causes the problems. That's because people who choose to eat a certain way may be different in other ways, such as income, ethnicity, education, community resources, exercise habits, and much more. And there's usually no good way to say for sure which factors cause a given health problem. One way to avoid the limitation of cohort studies is to fashion a randomized controlled trial, or RCT, in which people are randomly assigned to different diets. Any emerging differences in the health of the different diet groups could then be attributed with some confidence to the diet, because everything else about the group should, on average, be the same. There are reasons why dietary researchers don't do many RCTs. Getting people to agree to adopt a diet that they may not like is difficult, and those who do agree may have trouble sticking to the diet, which is why a good dietary RCT requires carefully monitoring what the subjects eat 24/7 at enormous inconvenience and cost. Requiring people to eat junk food for long periods of time would also be unethical, given the health risks. That's why the NIH study had only 20 patients eating ultra-processed food for a mere 2 weeks, numbers considered too small for reliable results. No wonder scientists and clinicians can't agree on the best approach to a healthy diet, and even if they did, would it have much of an effect on Americans' health? Haunting the entire endeavor of improving the public's diet is the fact that most people simply can't or won't make the long-term eating changes that experts recommend. Everyone hears that junk food isn't good for them, but it still dominates the diet of Americans, with no sign of change. Junk food is not only hyper-palatable, it's also cheap and convenient. Not everyone has access to a farmer's market or the time to cook food, says Bailey. We haven't begun to understand all the socioeconomic factors involved in helping people make changes. No number of new study conclusions is going to change those facts. Having largely failed at convincing most people to switch to some type of healthier diet and facing growing criticism of even trying, out of concern that it's a form of shaming, experts have taken to calling for regulation that would force the food industry to stop selling junk food, although there isn't a lot of hard evidence that restricting the marketing or even sale of junk food would improve the public's dietary health. The assumption seems reasonable. That's why in July the World Health Organization called for countries around the world to implement such regulation to protect children from junk food marketing. A regulation like that may be a pipe dream in the United States, where many people and most Republicans in Congress opposed restrictions on or taxes on food marketing or sales. These intrinsically healthy foods have to be regulated, says Montero. But the culture in the United States is very much against it. Republicans in Congress are willing to make one exception to that resistance to food regulation. They are currently pushing a ban on junk food purchases made with federal food aid benefits. Democrats insist such a law would unfairly target the poor. Marion Nessel, a New York University professor emeritus of nutrition and a leading advocate for Reforming America's Diet proposed a series of modest junk food-related regulations in a 2022 paper in the American Journal of Public Health, but she conceded that the proposed regulations may seem unrealistic and would confront formidable attitudinal, legal, and legislative hurdles. She called them aspirational. Other than the proposed legislation impacting food aid recipients, no junk food restrictions are currently under active consideration by Congress. Two California cities, Berkeley and Perez, have banned grocery stores from displaying junk food at checkout counters. Even the UK, which has proven far friendlier to anti-junk food regulation, was forced in June to back off a planned ban of two-for-one discounts for junk food items in grocery stores until at least 2025, due to objections over consumers having to pay more for food, even if it's junk food. Lacking any realistic hope of curbing the massive output of junk food, it's unclear what dietary changes might realistically be sold to the American public. Diet isn't simple, says Bailey, but people tend to take home a simple message. Still, there may be some wiggle room for improvement. Although most doctors can't convince their patients to make dietary changes, studies suggest most doctors don't follow the recommended approaches for counseling patients who are overweight, which include tailoring advice to each patient's specific eating habits and scheduling a follow-up conversation. Several studies indicate that doctors who follow these recommendations usually succeed in guiding patients to at least modest weight loss. This sort of practical advice, rather than the hawking of impressive-sounding theories, is where the most progress can be made, says Ard. We need to spend more time on the science of implementing our ideas and moving them into practice, he says. Yes, the environment promotes unhealthy eating, but that's not the same as saying we can't encourage people to take some level of responsibility for managing what they can in their diet. We can help them make small changes that can lead to significant impact. Getting people to cut down on sugary sodas, he says, would be a good place to start. As long as critics lambast such counseling as useless and shaming, and as long as nutrition scientists clash over differing views of the ideal diet while howling for regulation that has no chance of happening, little is likely to change. The consequences are measured in the millions of lives cut short. From the news, this Trump appointee may hold key to Biden's reelection bid, by Julia Carbonaro. Jerome Powell, who was appointed as chair of the Federal Reserve in 2017 by then-President Donald Trump, might hold the key to the future of the U.S. economy, experts have told Newsweek, and with it, the future of President Joe Biden's campaign for reelection next year. Powell has recently signaled that the central bank might once again raise its key interest rate in an attempt to bring down inflation, which at around 3% is much lower than the peak of 8.5% last year, but remains above the Fed's goal of 2%. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is taking credit for the country's strong economy. In a recent op-ed in the Washington Post, the president wrote that Bidenomics, which reflects his economic vision for the country, is working. Because of the major laws and executive orders I've signed from the American Rescue Plan, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, the CHIPS and Science Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, my executive orders on racial equity and more, we're advancing equity in everything we do, making unprecedented investments in all of America, including for Black Americans, Biden wrote. However, the Fed appears to disagree. Despite the resilience shown by the U.S. economy, driven by continued growth since the end of the pandemic, which has so far assuaged fears of an approaching recession, while Powell is not the only person making decisions at the Fed, he is the most important voice within the institution. Commenting on Powell's apparent intention to hike rates again, Robert Reich said, "Remember, Raising rates puts the burden of fighting inflation mostly on middle-class and low-wage workers and does nothing to address corporate price gouging. Newsweek columnist Reich was the Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton and is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Macroeconomist Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, told Newsweek that neither the Fed's rate hikes nor Biden's IRA had much of an impact on inflation, which dropped mostly because of the reversal of the supply chain problems that sent prices soaring in 2021 and the first half of 2022. The Federal Reserve's aggressive rate hikes since early 2022 have contributed to the slowing in inflation, while the Inflation Reduction Act is only now being implemented, Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics, told Newsweek. But far and away the most important reason for the slowing in inflation is the fading fallout from the pandemic on supply chains and labor markets, and Russian war in Ukraine on oil, food, and other commodity prices. Even though both initiatives helped relatively little, we have seen inflation come down close to the Fed's target, Baker added. It, the Fed, should have the luxury of sitting back and seeing where the inflation rate settles. This would be a huge victory, although we can argue over how much credit it deserves or whether the drop in inflation was inevitable, he told Newsweek. Further rate hikes by the Fed would increase the risk of a hard landing for the U.S. economy, Baker said. I'm hoping they don't. I can't see a reason for it, but I had overestimated the impact of past rate hikes, so perhaps that would be the case again. In a recent conversation between Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal, and former federal prosecutor Preet Bharara, the pair has also said the possibility of a recession in the U.S. will depend on the Fed continuing to hike interest rates. A lot of prospects of going into recession now are really based on how successful the Fed is in getting inflation down without having to raise rates to such a level that causes that sort of a recession, Ipp said during a podcast recording. According to Ipp, the Fed is likely to continue with its aggressive campaign of raising rates. I see an economy that still seems to be kind of stuck in a mode of thinking that inflation is here to stay, and the Federal Reserve will not be happy with that, he said. And, unfortunately, that tilts the odds towards the Fed keeping interest rates as high as they are now, and possibly even higher, eventually weakening the economy enough to produce something that looks like a recession. This could negatively impact Biden's chances of re-election during the presidential race next year, as, according to Ipp, what will influence voters most is what happens with inflation. I think that if the president gets lucky, we'll have inflation continuing to move down lower next year without a recession, Ipp told Bharara, adding that this soft landing is more in the hands of the Federal Reserve than it is in the hands of the president. The Fed will play a critical role in determining whether the U.S. suffers a recession in 2024, Zandi said. Policymakers must raise rates high enough, long enough, to slow growth and quell inflation, but not so high, so long, that it undermines the economy. We are close to the moment of truth on whether the Fed will successfully thread this needle, he added. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe and thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle. So it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.